is recording.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, well, thank you very much for having me. Thank you, Jenna. Thank you, Anne-Marie. My name's Charles Roche. I'm a radiologist here. I've been here at Roswell for about 10 years. My subspecialty is body imaging and oncologic imaging. Our department is subspecialized. So in radiology, just like in surgery or medicine, there are subspecialties. And so neuroradiology, for instance, is separate from body imaging. Nuclear medicine is typically a different subspecialty, and interventional radiology is a different subspecialty. We're going to kind of touch on several different topics in radiology. So what I'm going to try to do, I'll try to go through this quickly, and I'm going to highlight certain things that may be important for the exam, at least the questions that I've submitted. And, unfortunately, an hour, to condense all of radiology into 1 hour is almost impossible. So it's kind of a superficial view of what the different modalities are and what the different technologies are that we utilize. Okay, so let's get started. So I'm going to touch on radiography, which is the most basic form of imaging that we do. That's been around actually since Rankin took the first radiograph in the late 1800s. We've come a long ways now. We do digital radiography, but it's basically the same technology. Fluoroscopy, which I'll describe in detail. Computed tomography came about in the 1970s, and now it's widespread all through the world. There are many, many CT scanners in every city of almost every country. It's a very common technology today. Ultrasound as well. I'll touch on ultrasound a little bit. We don't use ultrasound as much as we do CT and MRI. A little bit about magnetic resonance imaging. And then interventional radiology, it's very interesting. Interventional radiology has really evolved over the last 10 years. We deliver chemotherapy and radionuclides via catheter directly to a tumor now. So we can actually do a local regional therapy of tumors, and I'll show you some examples of that. Nuclear medicine, which I mentioned, is kind of a separate subspecialty in our department and in most departments. This is the use of radioisotopes for the purpose of imaging. So you're not generating X-rays from an external source to create an image. You're actually relying on radioactive decay from inside the body to produce the images. And I'll show you a couple most common examples of that. Then I'm just going to touch a little bit on assessing tumor response. So obviously this is a big part of our job here. Patients will start therapy, and assessing how well they're responding to therapy or if the if they're failing to respond to therapy. And then I'll show you some examples, several examples at the end, several pictures of various types of tumors that we see in our practice. So this is a very basic schematic diagram here just to show you. So an X-ray tube, if you will, is basically a vacuum tube with a filament that relatively high voltage is applied across the filament, which induces current, and it produces electrons, which then travel through the vacuum tube and strike an anode, which is made of tungsten. Okay, so then X-rays are generated. We'll just briefly talk about the mechanism by which they're generated. But basically, because the tube is collimated, so there's lead shielding around the X-ray tube, which allows you to focus the X-ray beam toward the patient. And then you would have an imaging receptor or cassette behind the patient, okay? And so just real briefly, about 80% of X-ray photons in radiography are generated by the Bremsstrahlung effect, or breaking radiation. And basically, this is just when one of the electrons that have been generated at the cathode encounter or get relatively close to a nucleus in whatever tissue, in the tungsten, and the course and speed of the electron is deflected, and you get an X-ray photon that's generated. And generally, these photons are in the range of anywhere from 20 keV all the way up to about 140 kiloelectron volts in energy. The second way X-rays are generated, so same source, same tungsten anode, but this is the characteristic radiation. So this accounts for about 20% of the production of X-ray photons. And this is probably a more familiar mechanism to anybody that's taken chemistry and physics, where a high-energy electron strikes an electron in the electron cloud. The electron is displaced or ejected. An outer electron moves, is promoted, basically, to a different orbit, if you will, and an X-ray photon is generated in that process. So based on the electron that it strikes, you're going to have characteristic peaks that are unique to tungsten. So you end up with a distribution. This is the X-ray spectra for tungsten, where you can see you have a nice spread of the breaking type or Bremsstrahlung radiation, and then you have two characteristic peaks here that are unique to tungsten. So, and that's basically what we use for our anode in all devices. So whether it's fluoroscopy, CT, radiography, whatever, this is basically the X-ray spectra. Now this is going to determine how the tissues look on a radiograph. Okay, these energies and this distribution of energy of the X-ray photons is going to determine what we see on an X-ray. So now I'll give you so the basic densities you're going to see on plane radiography, the four that are natural, the last one would imply that there's some sort of foreign body or instrument in the patient. But basically you have air, fat, soft tissues, which would be things like solid organs, the heart, the liver, the spleen, etc., and fluid. For all intents and purposes, most of the organs are made up of water, so soft tissue and fluid are very similar. And then, of course, bone. And these densities that you can differentiate are based on the atomic or average atomic number of the tissues that you're looking at, right? So bone is going to be made up of elements of higher atomic number, so they're going to attenuate the X-ray beam much more so than air or fat, for instance. Now metal, which I just put up here, this is something where if a patient has a pacemaker or has had surgery and there's some metal left behind in the patient, then we'll see this, and this is even a higher attenuation than bone. So this is just a graphic representation of what we're going to see. So because there's very little beam attenuation with air, you basically, the image is going to be very dark where the air is, because basically the X-ray photons are just penetrating through with no impedance. And then as you go up the scale here to substances with a higher average atomic number, you're going to get more and more dense or opaque on the X-ray. So metal is going to be like a bright white, which basically means that very few photons have penetrated through the substance. So this is an example. I magnified this up just so you guys could see the differences. So this is just a left upper corner of a chest X-ray. And what we can see here, you can see bone. This is the clavicle or collarbone. The scapula is here. And these are all individual ribs here. And you can see the density matches up to what I was describing here based on its beam attenuation. The lungs are predominantly filled with air. So the attenuation of the X-ray beam is very low. So the lung appears very dark. If we look here along the midline, you see part of the spine, but in addition to that, this is the aorta coming down right here. This is the interface of the aorta and the lung, this line right here. And basically, this is yet a different density between the bone and the air. So it's more of a fluid attenuation. There's no metal in this particular case. This is an example of attenuation of fat. So this is soft tissue. This is some muscle around the left shoulder, right? These are the bone, the muscle, and then the fat, the sub-Q fat here. And then this would be the skin, this surface right here. So you can see these different densities on a radiograph. So just to show you a couple of examples of things that we see and how, so basically knowing how the X-ray beam should be attenuated normally by the various tissues, we're looking for something that looks out of place, right? So here there's this, you know, very obvious area of increased density or attenuation on this radiograph, and this is in the right lower lobe of the lung. Okay, you can see, you compare it to the left side, this side looks like it normally does. The heart is always slightly to the left of midline, so this is the heart shadow here. But this lung is clear. All you can see normally are the little vessels that sort of penetrate through the lung. But here's this opacity. So this is pneumonia that's developed in a patient who was on chemotherapy. So this opacity basically means that the spaces within the lung, the alveoli, which are normally air-filled, have become filled with fluid and pus. So basically the average atomic number has increased, therefore it looks more opaque on a radiograph. This is a different chest X-ray on a different patient, obviously. And in this particular case, we can see in the left lung this time, there's this very round shaped density in the left upper lobe. And this happened to be a primary lung cancer. So it's very well marginated. Pneumonias typically look very, you know, ill-defined, kind of amorphous or cloud-like. Tumors very often have a much more rounded and well-marginated appearance here. You can see the interface between the tumor and the normal lung much more clearly. So fluoroscopy, basically this is just a slight variation on radiography in the sense that instead of a static image being taken, we actually use a continuous source of X-rays, and the image is actually projected onto a monitor, so that you can monitor a dynamic process in the body. And so this would be things like you may have heard of an upper GI, a barium enema, things of that sort. So this is an example of a barium enema. It's double contrast. This patient is actually, this is the spine, and the pelvis is here. This would be the cranial direction, so the head would be up here somewhere. The patient is lying on the table. But if you notice here that actually this dense material is the barium suspension. The barium is basically a metal, so you have high beam attenuation, which is why it looks so opaque. And then other parts of the colon are filled with air, which look very dark. But you can see these air fluid levels or barium air levels. The patient's actually in a left lateral decubitus position. They're lying on their side, which is why all of these air fluid levels line up like this. Okay. What this basically allows us to do, we can watch real time as we're filling the colon with barium and air, right? And we make sure we get all the way around to the right colon. So you can see this, the colon can be very tortuous. But what we're looking for here, the barium will coat tumors in the colon or potentially polyps in the colon. This happens to be a normal double contrast barium enema. Very nice outline of the normal configuration of the colon. With no masses or polyps seen. This used to be the most common way to screen for colon cancer prior to the optical colonoscopy that the gastroenterologists do becoming so common. So pretty much now, double contrast barium enema. The reason we do barium enemas here at Roswell are for preoperative assessment. If there's a very particular question that the surgeon wants answered before they go to the operating room, or in the case of a post-operative patient that has an abscess and there's a question of a bowel leak, Sometimes we do a study like this to look at the bowel to see if we can find the source of the leak. But very rarely now are barium enemas being used to screen for colon cancer. This is an example of an upper GI. This also happens to be normal. So the patient, the difference here is the patient drinks the contrast. You can see the esophagus nicely outlined here. This is the stomach. And then the duodenum is here. And then this is the first part of the small intestine. So again, you can watch as the contrast moves through the various parts of the GI tract. You can watch the peristalsis of the esophagus and stomach to see if there's normal muscle activity or if there's dysmotility. You can look for things like ulcers or tumors anywhere in the GI tract with this technique. Okay, so now just to switch to CT. All right, so basically we're still using X-ray photons. So there's ionizing radiation. I'm going to get to that in a second. So the difference with this is instead of a fixed position of an X-ray source, the X-ray source is mounted on a gantry, and the X-ray source moves 360 degrees around the patient. So instead of taking a one-angle, one-shot image, you're actually moving the X-ray source and the detectors around the patient very rapidly, and you're able to measure the various tissues from different angles, the attenuation coefficients of the different tissues in the body at various angles. And basically, they're spatially located pixels. The CT and MR that I'll show you later uses a 512 by 512 matrix. And each pixel is assigned a density value based on all of the attenuation coefficients calculated from the rotation of the X-ray source and detector. So then we generate images. We use iodinated contrast, which I'll show you an example of the importance of iodinated contrast. So iodine is basically a metal. So we use this increases X-ray beam attenuation, but different tissues in the body take up different amounts of iodinated contrast, so we can see differences in tissue much better because of the use of this. So ionizing radiation, this also uses ionizing radiation, so radiography, fluoroscopy, CT use ionizing radiation. And you guys are, you know, familiar with this, but this basically means that either directly or indirectly, photons of this energy can cause damage to DNA. So either through the production of free radicals, which damage DNA, or direct damage to DNA. So this is what a modern CT scanner looks like. This is the table the patient lays on. This is the gantry I was referring to. So we're going to look at a cutaway here, which just shows you this is the X-ray beam source where the X-ray tube is housed, right? The detector lies on the opposite side, and there's actually multiple detectors, so it's a detector array. And this whole gantry spins around the patient. So this fan beam of photons rotates around the patient, and that's how you calculate the attenuation coefficients of various tissues. So this right here. So this is the idea of assigning various pixels with a density value that you can see here based on the X-rays penetrating through each of these portions of tissue from different angles. You end up with a density assignment, and then that creates this image. So just to show you here, so now we're getting in much more detail. So you saw a general plain radiograph of the chest, and you can see the ribs, you can see the lungs, the bone obviously was quite different, but now you're getting much more differentiation of all the various tissues. So this happens to be a scan with contrast, and I'll show you the difference between pre and post contrast in a minute. But basically here you can see the outline of the liver. This is the gallbladder right here. Here's the stomach, and it contains some barium suspension that the patient drank before they got on the table. That's why there's all this high-density material in the stomach. And this here, the structure right here, is the pancreas. You can see your adrenal glands, your kidneys. So the kidneys are very, very vascular, lots and lots of blood flow, which is why they're enhancing even more than the liver or the pancreas or other soft tissues that you see. So the amount of contrast enhancement or iodine uptake is going to be dependent directly upon blood flow to that particular organ. Now, this happens to be a normal single slice image through the abdomen, but we'll see that actually contrast can help tumors stand out as well. So you can, you know, obviously the kidneys look different from the liver, but most tumors in the liver are going to look different than the normal liver. All right. So here's a couple of cases. This is a CT of a chest, and just to show you what a lung tumor would look like. So you see this lobulated area of increased density. So just think it through. The average atomic number of the cells is higher here than the rest of the lung, so it shows up as an opacity here. So this is something that obviously, if you were looking at this CAT scan, it looks like a mass. It doesn't quite have the shape or configuration of pneumonia. So you would be concerned about this. So the next thing you would do is biopsy this lesion to get tissue for pathology. This is an example of a CT of the abdomen with contrast, and there's multiple liver metastases. So these are relatively hypovascular compared to the normal parenchyma. Therefore, they appear less dense or darker. Okay, you can see here there's several lesions. This is metastatic colorectal cancer. This is something a little bit different. This is actually a CT of a head without contrast. And this is a patient that was on anticoagulation therapy for pulmonary emboli or clots in the lungs. And this patient developed, after a relatively minor trauma, a large epidural hematoma. So blood, if blood accumulates in large portions, it becomes much more dense than any of the normal brain tissue surrounding it. So this is all hematoma right here. So just a little bit, just to show you an example of the importance of contrast. So on the left is a CT with no contrast. On the right, we have an arterial phase post-contrast CT. The aorta, you can see here, is very, very bright. So we're in an arterial phase. And the liver here, if you had no contrast, you would say this looks pretty homogeneous and normal. None of these pixels here stand out from any of the others. They're kind of all blended in and look about the same. You give contrast, and because these tumors are hypervascular relative to normal liver, they're enhancing much more than the surrounding liver. So this is how we kind of coax these tumors. And we know that certain tumors are hypervascular and certain tumors are hypovascular. So for instance, colorectal metastases are almost always hypovascular. But tumors that tend to be hypervascular, such as hepatocellular carcinoma, carcinoid tumors, neuroendocrine tumors, things like that, we image in the arterial phase to try to exploit this difference in physiology so that we can find these tumors. So just quickly to ultrasound now. So basically, electrical energy is converted to sound waves. This is the piezoelectric effect. It's a mechanical generation of conversion of electrical energy to sound waves. Then basically the ultrasound probe. So the ultrasound probe does this, and then it listens for a return echo, in which case the sound waves or echoes are reconverted back to electrical energy. So frequency is typically 5 to 10 megahertz, which is very ultrasonic. I'll show you on the scale in a moment. And it exploits differences. So not only do various tissues have differences in average atomic number of the atoms that compose it, but they also have slightly different acoustic impedance. So I'll show you a little diagram that demonstrates that. There's no ionizing radiation with ultrasound. So you're using ultrasonic frequency sound waves, and there are really no known deleterious effects from ultrasound. They studied this, you know, quite a bit, especially in obstetrics, where they do fetal ultrasound, and they've been looking at this for years to see if there's any effect on the fetus with these ultrasonic waves. They've never been able to demonstrate any deleterious effects from ultrasound. So no ionizing radiation, very safe to use, and relatively inexpensive compared to CT and MRI. And let's go to the next slide here. So this is that chart I was showing you. So you see the various, just to show you the scale here, you can see that, you know, human hearing, you're in this range, and ultrasound, diagnostic ultrasound, you're way up in this range. So it's very, very high ultrasonic frequencies that you're talking about. All right, so this is the other diagram I was mentioning where this, the echoes are generated, or the sound is generated here. This is the ultrasound probe. Okay, basically then the sound waves, encounter an interface between two various types of tissue and their return echoes. And basically, you can determine the acoustic impedance of the tissues, and that's all based on velocity and frequency of the echoes. Then you get an image that's generated. And here it's just showing you the different layers of tissue and where you're going to have an echo interface based on this. So here's sub-Q fat. The probe is on the skin, and then you have muscle, and then there's bone in this particular case. But these are all going to reflect the sound waves differently. So this is an image of an ultrasound. This is a normal ultrasound of an abdomen in the right upper quadrant. And so the probe is up here. So this, you can see this very thin layer of skin right here. And then you have the subcutaneous fat. You have a layer of muscle. And then you have the liver, which is right here, this whole structure right here. And then this is the right kidney. So you can see that the acoustic impedance of the liver is different than the kidney. So we can differentiate tissues and organs. It gives us a look. You can see that the field of view isn't as great as on a CT. So you're only looking at smaller portions, of the abdomen, and you can only penetrate to a certain depth, and ultrasound is not good for looking at bone. The sound waves can't penetrate bone. So there are some limitations. It's a nice, convenient imaging modality if you want to look for swelling of the kidney or hydronephrosis. You can see the kidneys very well. And if you want to look for kidney stones, it's another nice way to do that. This is an abnormal liver ultrasound, and you can just see there's two liver metastases here. And you can see that the differences aren't quite as great as you would expect to see in a CAT scan, but there definitely is a slightly different acoustic impedance to the tumor than the normal liver. All right, so MRI. Okay. So, obviously know that it uses a magnetic field. The important thing with magnetic resonance imaging as opposed to nuclear magnetic resonance, which is used in a laboratory, is that when you're imaging, you have to spatially locate signals that you're getting back. So the way you do that is through you use a gradient magnetic field. So for instance, if you imagine a patient lying on a table getting an MRI, the magnetic field at the position of the head is much different than the magnetic field at the position of the feet. So there's a gradient there, and that's what allows you to spatially locate where the return signals, the RF signals, are coming from. So basically, you place the patient in this gradient magnetic field, you get proton spin alignment, and it's predominantly protons and water. The body's made up mostly of water. So a proportion of these protons, it's a relatively small proportion actually, the total amount of water, but several of the protons spin align with the magnetic field. Then an RF pulse is generated by the magnet, by the MRI unit, and it deflects a small percentage of the protons from this alignment. Then you turn the RF pulse off, the protons return to their original spin in the gradient magnetic field, and they emit an RF signal. So basically you turn on an RF pulse, you take it off, and then the magnet listens for the radio frequency that comes back when the protons go back to their alignment in this gradient magnetic field. Okay? So again, spatial location is based or due to the gradient. The RF signal strength that you're going to get back depends on the proton environment. If you're a water molecule surrounded by other water molecules, and you happen to be in the kidney, your RF signal is going to be different than if you were in the liver. So different cells have different concentrations of water. They're exposed to, different concentrations of various other elements. So the proton environment does vary in different tissues of the body, and that's what allows us to see all of the different organs and separate them from each other. So you get image reconstruction, and again, there is no ionizing radiation. Now, the only thing, just to tell you, it's a very safe technology, but clinical magnets are getting stronger and stronger in terms of the magnetic field strength. The first magnets that came out were less than one Tesla. Now we're routinely using a 3 Tesla magnet, 1.5 Tesla and 3 Tesla magnets, and there's even some places that are using 7 Tesla magnets for clinical imaging. Research magnets go all the way up to 12 or 15 Tesla, but those aren't approved for use in humans. And what you do get, you don't have ionizing radiation, but because of the magnetic field and the RF pulses and so forth, there's a lot of energy deposition into the body. So people come out sometimes feeling almost feverish. You can actually break a good sweat in a magnet because of the energy deposition. So it doesn't. There's no ionizing radiation, but there's definitely some effect on the tissues. So this is an example of MRI of the brain. This is normal. And just to show you here, so bone happens to be dark on MRI because the few protons in this particular environment don't emit a very strong signal on MRI. So it's the opposite of what you would expect on a CAT scan. A CAT scan, the bone looks very bright, and an MRI, it's dark. Here you can see brain parenchyma, the sulci, gyri of the brain, and these are the central ventricles here, and fluid, this is a T2 weighted sequence, so fluid is very bright. So that's the other thing, you can tweak the RF pulse emission by the magnet to try to exploit differences in proton spins. So you have, with regard to CT, you're basically just measuring attenuation coefficients of tissues. With MRI, you can actually exploit subtle differences in proton environment in various tissues of the body, and you can have multiple different types of sequences. So this is, for instance, this is a T1 weighted sequence. It's definitely different than this T2 weighted sequence, and this is the abdomen. This is the liver here. This is the spleen, aorta, and this is the spine. And you can see here the sub-Q fat. You can see a layer of the abdominal wall musculature here. This is the rectus abdominis muscle. And you can see some bowel loops right here. All right. So that's just to give you an idea of what an MRI sort of looks like. And what we do, so instead of iodinated contrast, we use gadolinium-based contrast for MRI. So again, you can see the relative importance here. So you can see this lesion in the left frontal lobe. On this T1 sequence, on this non-contrast sequence, this image. Very subtle, but definitely there. But you see, you give contrast, and you can see how much more conspicuous that the mass becomes. And you could potentially find smaller lesions elsewhere in the brain. So this is metastatic breast cancer. And fortunately, this patient only has one lesion. So this could be targeted with a gamma knife. And treated that way, and she didn't have any other lesions. This is an example of MRI of a liver, but that has a large tumor in the periphery. And so these are the different sequences. So like I said, you can try to exploit differences. You see the tumor looks a little bit darker here than here. So this is actually a hepatocellular carcinoma. And this has very bright enhancement, and then by the time you get to a later phase, you wait a little bit longer, let the contrast wash out, and you can see, so this is very typical of a hepatocellular carcinoma. They take up a lot of contrast, and the contrast washes out very fast, so it goes from bright to dark. Okay, so just to give you a sense of how some of these tumors, how we can differentiate some of these tumors by imaging. They have different physiologic characteristics, and sometimes with imaging, we can exploit those differences. So interventional radiology. So this is interesting. This is the specialty I was saying that's really evolved over the past decade or two, especially. Basically, the principle is you insert a very small gauge catheter within either a peripheral vein or artery. You then basically advance that catheter to a point in the body that you want to take a look at. So if you're looking at, for instance, the coronary arteries in a coronary angiogram, you obviously want to get up into the ascending aorta and then get out into like the left main coronary artery or the right coronary and so forth. So using fluoroscopy, they can advance that catheter and target certain vessels, advance the catheter into those vessels, and then inject contrast so they can see fine details of vasculature. They use digital subtraction fluoroscopy. So I'll explain a little bit about that. Basically, it's fluoroscopy, but you take a masked image, which is an image with no contrast, and then you inject contrast and you subtract the one image from the other, and that removes the bone and other things so that you can see the contrast very nicely. This uses ionizing radiation, and we'll get into, I'll show you a couple of examples of catheter-directed therapy. So it can be used for diagnosis as well as therapy. So this is an example of what I was talking about. This here is an angiographic catheter, and this is in the abdominal aorta. And what they did here is they injected, this is a preoperative planning study for partial liver resection. So what they did here, they injected the celiac artery. This is the hepatic artery. And you guys don't need to worry about all these details. It's just to show you how much you can actually see with these digital subtraction angiograms. And you can see all the branches of the common hepatic artery here. You can follow them. You can see how far out you can follow these things. So this is an example of a digital subtraction angiogram of the liver. And this is an example of a DSA of the liver, but showing liver metastases. So all of these areas where there's this blush of contrast or increased vascularity at the site of prominent angiogenesis, these areas have, you can see this blush of enhancement. These are all tumors in the liver. So you can imagine your catheter is right here. If you could get this out a little bit further, you could potentially deliver something through this catheter to treat this tumor. Okay, so this is just a very general schematic, and this is what I was talking about. Here's your catheter. You inject either radioisotopes or radioactive particles or particles that contain chemotherapy. So like these little microspheres, they can contain chemotherapy or radioactive isotopes. You deliver it directly to the tumor, and you're treating the tumor locally as opposed to systemically with chemotherapy. This is an example of transarterial chemoembolization. So that's, we just call that TACE. So this is the pre-procedure angiogram. You can see they just injected contrast here. And you can see this blush here in the lower part of the liver. This is where the tumor is. All right. And what they did after they took this image, they injected these microspheres that contain chemotherapy. And that does two things. The microspheres occlude the small arteries. So basically you're choking off the tumor. It makes the tumor ischemic. But also, as those little microspheres dissolve, they release chemotherapy into the territory that those arteries supply, which is right to the tumor. So this is post-TACE, and you can see now you no longer see that tumor blush. So this is what the interventional radiologists are looking for when they do these procedures. After they treat it, they want to make sure there's no residual flow to the tumor. So the other thing interventional radiology does, image-guided biopsies. You need to sample tissue for various pathology studies and stains and analyses, and you've got to get the tissue. You could either get it surgically, or now it's probably most common and less invasive than surgery is using imaging to actually guide a needle to a tumor and getting tissue that way. You can also do image-guided percutaneous ablations. So this is a little bit different. It's from a percutaneous approach or from outside the body. You can actually use radio frequency ablation or microwaves to kind of cook or destroy a tumor. They have cryoablation where you're freezing it. They have alcohol ablation of cysts, and then arterial and venous embolization that we'll talk about. So you can do all kinds of various things with these percutaneous treatments. So this is an example of an image-guided biopsy of a lung tumor. So the patient is lying supine or prone, rather, belly down on the CT table, and this needle is inserted through the back, through this part of the lung, and directly in the tumor. So we can know that we're in the tumor because the images that we get. So we take images as the needle is going further and further to make sure we're on target, and we get into there, and then we take core biopsies of the lesion. This is an ultrasound-guided biopsy. So again, there's a liver mass that's being biopsied. This echogenic surface here that you see, that's actually the needle. So you can actually, under the ultrasound probe, you can watch your needle go in, make sure you're on target, and then start taking cores of the mass. And you can see on the CT that the patient had just before the biopsy, this is where the tumor was, in the right lobe of the liver. This is just a diagram of what a RF ablation would look like. So again, it's a percutaneous needle placement. You're going through the liver here. Here's the tumor. So you get to the outer edge of the tumor, and then you deploy electrodes here. So then basically you turn on your radio frequency or microwaves or whatever source you're using, and then basically you burn the tumor, and you're left with this cavity afterwards. Okay. Now, there are some limitations. For instance, tumors over 3 centimeters are not very ideal for RF ablation. So it's typically 3 centimeters or smaller. The other thing is that if you're obviously very close to a blood vessel, the blood vessels can act as a heat sink, and you don't get very effective RF ablation. So it's a very nice technique and much less invasive than actually doing a surgery where you're taking out a large portion of the liver to remove the tumor, but there are some inherent limitations to it. Okay, so again, this is just a diagram showing you the chemoembolization, which we already talked about. That's a duplicate. Okay. So what I wanted to show here, this is an example. Now, this is non-tumor treatment, but this is a digital subtraction angiogram of a kidney. It's the outline of the kidney and all the branches of the renal artery. And this is a large aneurysm coming off of the renal artery. So this is what an aneurysm would look like. The thing you could do, the vascular procedure, so what they do is they snake a wire inside the aneurysm, so they coil it. This induces thrombosis of the aneurysm. All right, and then this is a post-procedure angiogram showing normal flow to the kidney, but now there's no more contrast or flow inside the aneurysm. So this aneurysm is successfully thrombosed and no longer at risk of rupturing. So that's a way that aneurysms are treated, one of the ways. All right, let's just switch to nuclear medicine. I know it's kind of, we don't have too much time left, but so basically, like I said at the beginning, using radiopharmaceuticals to diagnose and treat disease. So these are radioactive elements administered to the patient either orally or intravenously. And then we detect the radioactive decay, the gamma ray emission from radioactive decay from these particles. So we're not using an external X-ray source. And you can imagine there is some radiation dose to this, obviously. The tissue is immediately adjacent to the radioisotope. You do get a dose of, quote, ionizing radiation from the gamma rays. And so some examples that I'll talk about, and that you may have heard of here, is a PET scan or positron emission tomography and a bone scan. These are like two of the most commonly performed nuclear medicine studies here because these are used to detect tumors. There's several nuclear medicine procedures I won't go into because we don't do them frequently here. And then some therapies, just to give you an example. So in patients with thyroid cancer, you can use iodine 131. And what this does, the thyroid takes up iodine, and then you get radioactive decay of this isotope, which destroys the thyroid tumor. And then yttrium 90 is used for the IR procedure, where you deliver a radioisotope directly to the tumor via the artery that supplies it. So with regard to PET scans, so the agent we use is it's a radioactive fluoride isotope, and it's attached to glucose. So we just call it FDG. The half-life is just over 1.5 hours, decays by positron emission. And the principle of PET is that tissues that are highly metabolically active, and most tumors fall into that category, they take up a greater proportion of FDG or glucose than normal surrounding tissues. So that's the principle by which PET works. They use then incident gamma ray detectors are utilized to measure the positrons, gamma rays. The gamma rays that are produced by the positrons annihilating. And a CT scan is usually performed concurrently, so we call it a PET CT. The CT allows you to localize what tissues you're looking at in the body, and I'll show you why, because if you look at a PET scan alone, there's not really much anatomic detail. There's just that physiologic detail. So the PET CT combination allows you to not only see the abnormal areas of FDG accumulation, but to localize them accurately in the body. So this is a PET scanner. It looks just like a CT scanner, but in addition to the to an X-ray source with detectors here, okay, there's also incident gamma ray detectors built into this gantry. So you're doing both. So a little more detail than you need, but this is the idea that this is an incident gamma ray detector. So here and then here. So gamma rays are produced when this positron encounters an electron, they annihilate. And then that's the, as F18 decays, this process occurs. And then this allows you to generate, this process here is what allows you to generate the image on a PET scan. So this is an example of a PET CT, and they reconstructed this so you're looking at it in a coronal instead of an axial plane. And you can see that the CT gives you the information, okay, this is where the liver is, and then the PET scan, the data is overlaid with the anatomic information. You can see a large hypermetabolic mass in the liver. So, for instance, the kidney shows some normal uptake, some normal activity, but you're looking for areas that are abnormally high FDG activity. So there's tumors here in the lung, here and here, tumor in the liver, and then there's also tumors in the bone down here. So you're adding physiologic information to the anatomic information with a PET CT. This is an axial image. It shows you, so if you're only looking at a CAT scan, this is a non-contrast CT, by the way. So you're looking at the liver here, and you know, maybe there's something very subtle here, but once you add the FDG and you overlay the image, you can see that there's multiple hypermetabolic tumors throughout the liver. So just quickly, just to talk about a bone scan. So the agent we use is actually, it's 99M technetium. Its half-life is 6 hours, and it decays by gamma emission. Now, the difference is here is MDP actually adsorbs onto the crystalline structure of bone. So it's not taken up by cells in the sense that FDG is. It sort of bonds itself to the crystalline structure of bone. And the principle by which it operates is the higher the rate of bone turnover. So as you're waiting several hours, right, the greater the activity, radioactive activity of MDP at that site. Okay. So the idea is if there's tumor in the bone, and I'll show you some examples of a bone abnormal bone scan, but tumor is damaging the bone, and the bone is trying to repair itself. So there's increased bone turnover, so you would expect increased activity. The one caveat is if there's trauma, like a recent fracture, you can actually get a false positive, because this also is going to cause increased bone turnover and potentially infection as well. So the history is very important. You know, if there's been any recent trauma and so forth, you need to know this stuff if you're interpreting these images. But this here is a normal bone scan. So you can see the faint outline of the skeleton. Okay, and this happens to be a normal bone scan. these little areas here that are a little bit asymmetric. There's some arthritis in the knees and so forth, right? But it's a very symmetrical distribution and a commonly located sites for arthritis. This is a bone scan of a patient with prostate cancer that we did that shows numerous large bone metastases, right? So these are all areas where there's increased bone turnover because of tumor, but they're in the skull, the spine, the humeri, the ribs, the pelvis, the femurs, and even all the way down into the tibia right near the ankle. So we do a frontal or AP view and a posterior PA view because you can see certain bones a little bit better in the different projections. But and then what we can do is we can repeat this scan after therapy to see how much the activity is diminished. So again, you're getting some physiologic information, not only anatomic, but some physiologic information. Okay, so just quickly assessing tumor response. So there's actually several different types of measurement criteria we can utilize, but RECIST is the most common. So if you read some papers on certain trials that are being done with new agents that are developed or what have you, they'll talk about the use of RECIST to determine response to tumor therapy. And all this basically is, so it stands for response evaluation criteria in solid tumors. They've modified these criteria a couple of times. So it's just published rules that we apply to assessing scans. And the basic principle is you assess tumors at a baseline with imaging, you initiate therapy, and then you do a set determined follow-up imaging. Say, for instance, it's 6 weeks. Some of the protocols might be 8 weeks, but generally you're looking at following up the tumors from 6 weeks of initiation of therapy to see what they're doing. So this is just an example. This is all the same patient, but the cuts are taken at a different level. These are all of the chest, essentially, and upper abdomen. But here you can see initially there was a right lung tumor here. It got much bigger, so you can see it progressed here. All right. This is the first restaging scan after changing therapy. Okay, you can see it shrink. And then this is the second restaging scan. So this would be 12 weeks after therapy, and you can see how much smaller the mass has progressively gotten. So we measure these tumors for the oncologists and for the study researchers, and then they calculate, you know, the percentage of decrease in size of the tumor to get a quantitative assessment of how effective the therapy was. So that's the lung tumor. Here there's some pleural-based tumors, which also, after initiation or change of therapy, these tumors have gotten much smaller. And this is yet an example of another mass here. And this was a case that was also a malignant pleural effusion, so there's fluid around the lung, and that decreased and essentially resolved with this new therapy. So, and now just to show you some examples, just of various tumors to see what sort of stuff we commonly see here. So this is a CT of an abdomen with contrast, and this is a large renal cell carcinoma. You can see that this is the normal right-sided kidney, and over here you can see the tumor has replaced almost the entire kidney, and there's tumor invasion into the vein. So there's a large vein that drains the kidneys, and there's tumor extension here. You can see the difference in attenuation of the tumor versus where the contrast is in the vein. So this is all tumor, and renal cell carcinomas have a tendency to do that. They tend to invade the vein, and this has surgical implications, obviously, for the urologist that's going to do a nephrectomy for surgical planning. This is an example of ovarian cancer. This was a mass that was incidentally detected in a relatively young patient. I believe she was 40 years old. And there's a very large, these tumors can get very, very large before patients typically notice symptoms because they occur in the lower abdomen or pelvis. And there's a lot of soft organs and fat that can be displaced by the tumor, so you don't really notice many significant symptoms really early on. So this tumor was about 15 or 16 centimeters in size, and you can see that if there's cystic, there's some fluid here. So there's like a cystic component, and then there's also these solid components here that are enhancing. So this is kind of a relatively typical appearance of a large primary ovarian cancer. This is another example of hepatocellular carcinoma. This happens to be somebody with hepatitis C. This is a very large dominant mass in the right lobe. So this is somebody that would be disqualified from liver transplant based on the size of the tumor, and it'd be very difficult. You'd have to initiate chemotherapy to shrink this down if you were planning on doing catheter-directed therapy or so forth, because this tumor is so large. So that's occasionally when we see that, the treatment options are limited for the patient. So this is a glioblastoma, which is a very aggressive primary brain tumor. And so we can see the tumor here centrally, and this other area of high signal intensity around the tumor, this is all peritumoral edema. So there's lots of swelling of the brain around the tumor. And often it's this swelling and accumulation of edema that causes the symptoms and problems. You get brain herniation. So part of the left lobe can herniate over into the space where the right frontal lobe normally occupies, because the edema can be so profound. And this is just an example. This is a mammogram, and this is a primary breast cancer. So again, in mammography, this is essentially radiography, just of the breast, not of other body parts. So there is ionizing radiation, a relatively low dose compared to a chest x-ray or other types of x-rays. But you can see here, this is going to depend on the average atomic number of the various tissues. You can see the pectoralis muscle here, relatively dense. And then this is the breast, which overall is lower density, and then the tumor here. And that's essentially it. I know there was a lot there, but it's kind of a huge specialty in terms of the various modalities and things that we see. So I hope that kind of gave you a little bit of an overview of cancer imaging. You guys have any questions? Or? Yeah?
Could you explain the principle behind MRI again?
Yes. Let me, what I'll do here is I'll actually go back. Just to show you the diagram. So basically, you can envision an MR scanner looks very much, I don't have a picture of an MR scanner in the slides here, but you can imagine it looks very similar to a CT scanner. It's a bit bigger, but very similar to a CT scanner. And a patient is lying on a table, and the patient is then, the table and the patient are then moved into the gantry. Okay, the bore of the magnet. And the magnetic field is higher, for instance, at the patient's head, the front of the table, and it's lower at the bottom of the table, right? So there's a magnetic field gradient. That gradient is what allows you to spatially locate, you know, where the different tissues are, because if you think about it, you're in a magnetic field, you're applying an RF pulse, signals are coming from everywhere in the body. The magnet has to, the MR unit has to figure out, well, I'm going to create an image, but where do I make this image, right? So it's that gradient that clues the MR unit into where they should assign pixels to a certain image. So it's spatial location. But basically, so it's all dependent on proton spin. So you can imagine if you just envision water molecules, everything's kind of in a random, protons are spinning in random directions. When you place them into a strong magnetic field, a proportion of those protons, not all of them, but a proportion of them all line up with the magnetic field. Okay, so they artificially line up with the magnetic field. So you're changing the direction of those protons. Right? So now they're sitting in that magnetic field, and say you have 5% of the protons that are all facing in the same direction. Then you apply an RF pulse, and it takes those protons and it knocks them off by a certain angle, 20 degrees, 50 degrees, whatever. Then you let the RF pulse off, and they flip back up. When they flip back, an RF signal is emitted. So now the MR unit goes from generating an RF frequency or creating sound to now listening of what signal is coming back. Okay, that is. So based on the strength and frequency of the signal and the magnetic gradient, the pixels in an image are assigned a signal intensity, bright to dark, similar but not identical to CT, and they're spatially located because of the gradient. And the the principle is that the proton environment is different in different tissues. So protons in the liver are experiencing things a little bit differently than protons in the spleen and protons in the bone and protons in fat and so forth. So you exploit that slight difference to help you create an image. But that's in the most, I guess, basic way that I can describe it. You can imagine the physics gets quite complicated, but that's basically the principle by which MRI works. And then the important thing is you do, like I said, you do get some energy or heat deposition into tissues, but there is no ionizing radiation. So ultrasound and MRI, there's no ionizing radiation. Pretty much with every other modality, you have ionizing radiation, including nuclear medicine. It's by a different mechanism, but there's definitely ion. You can get DNA damage from the radioisotope decay. Anything else? Okay. All right, thank you. Yeah.
So the image of something that's more of just an example of what you're seeing, or is this something that we should be able to know, like this came
from just
this
an example.
Person? Okay.
Yeah, no,
all
no,
right.
No. I mean, the questions might be like, which of these utilizes ionizing radiation?
Okay.
You know, it's pretty much going to be stuff that's actually written down.
Right.
You're not going to need to know any anatomy or,
okay,
or images. Pneumonia versus tumor. Don't have to worry about that. Yeah, you're welcome.